In our modern view, we do not separate our human selves from our bestial selves by the clear divisions of rational versus irrational. For us, the human animal is just that, linking both reason and passion. For the most part, we expect our reason to be able to override our passion. Thus, we join our medieval ancestors in marking ourselves human by our intellect. Our modern view of ourselves as animals and the related concerns that emerge from this view had their roots in Western Europe in the 12th century. In our definition of what it means to be human, it seems we cannot deny for long the beast within us.
If you thought that Darwin was the first to blur the line between human and animal, well, you're probably surprised to hear that by the time he came along, the distinction had already been muddled for some 700 years. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What do medieval attitudes towards animals tell us about the way we interact with animals today? How did animals bring out the best and the worst in humans? And if medieval humans could act like animals, could animals act like humans? And what caused the distinction between animal and human to break down? Our guest is Joyce Salisbury, Emeritus Professor of History at the UW Green Bay and author of several books on medieval subjects, including the newly published book, The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is the second edition of your book, The Beast Within. So you've been thinking about and writing about this topic of animals in the Middle Ages for some time. I noticed that your introduction has as its title, What is an Animal? And so maybe we can start there. What is an animal, and how did the medieval thinkers kind of grapple with the question of how humans kind of relate and don't relate to animals?
Well, that's starting with a big question. Of course, what is an animal in the Christian context was defined in large part by what had a soul and what didn't. So in the medieval Christian context, humans had souls and animals did not, and everything else derived from that. But if a human had a soul, that meant a human had more intellect, had more reason, could override their passions. So then they began to divide human as rational, animal as not. So from that, everything else fell.
Did that create a certain responsibility of humans towards animals?
Well, you'd think it would, wouldn't it? And in part, the origin of Adam naming the animals, which was the standard baseline biblical account of our relationship to animals, when Adam could name the animals, that means he understood the animals, he understood their role. Their animals' role was to be useful for humans, and humans' role, to be honest, was only to take advantage of that relationship.
Well, and you talk about the dominion line and the idea that we kind of control animals. They are there for our purpose.
And they are there for our purpose. And so an animal in the medieval context that's useless has no purpose for us. So if a wolf is eating your sheep, you're perfectly within your rights to kill that wolf and all the wolves. The same with bears or anything else that got in your way. No animal had a value to its intrinsic in itself. All animals' value was only for us. And we've come a long way from that with the environmental movement, although tentatively, I think.
You can get sort of semantic about that, can't you, as to whether the animal has a benefit to us or not in terms of the environmental context. I mean, sure, the wolf immediately, if it eats your sheep, does not have a use, but it environmentally in the greater picture and the aesthetic picture and all that, of course, we're realizing that it's a bigger issue than just the immediate relationship with you and your livestock, say.
Yes. And in fact, the latest views, even theologians, are suggesting that unlike in the Middle Ages where they believed no animal would go to heaven, now some theologians are suggesting, well, sure, animals will go to heaven as a giant web in which we are all related. So the whole web goes to heaven.
Every little centipede right
yes.
on down.
So we'll meet the wolves again. Perhaps they'll be more pleasant in the next life.
But the upshot of it is that the relationship really is one of ownership, isn't it?
Yes. Property is the baseline relationship of humans with animals, with domestic animals. Wild animals obviously are not owned in the medieval context. Therefore, they can be killed or used in whatever fashion. But if an animal is domestic, its property. It's yours. And that's a relationship that appears to tie the animal to us in a very real way. But I suggest the relationship is more complicated. We're as owned by our property as our
as our vet bills would indicate.
Exactly. Exactly. There are some people who have argued, for example, that we didn't domesticate the animals. The animals domesticated us. One imagines the cow thinking, well, it's hard work making a living. Perhaps I'll domesticate some people.
Every time you curry a horse, you know, you have to kind of wonder, wait a minute, who owns whom here?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, and I think Thoreau said men are not the keepers of herds. Herds are the keeper of men. That once you start the process of agriculture or you start, you know, having cattle and so on, it's a lot of work.
You got into a contract early on that committed us to a lot of work. The latest discussion, for example, on whether we domesticated wolves and turned them into dogs, there is some suggestion that perhaps those tame-ish wolves lurking around our early camps taught us more than we taught them. For example, they taught us to value more a pack larger than just the family bond, like monkeys.
Oh.
So we learned from canines that maybe we should be in larger packs. So
cooperative behavior. Hmm.
Cooperative behavior, exactly.
Well, that's a fascinating theory.
You include in your book in the appendices, you've got all these kind of charts showing the different value of animals versus people and so on. Can you say something about the documents you use if you're writing your chapter, Animals Are as Property, and you're working to figure out what were medieval attitudes towards property, animals? What kinds of things did you actually look at to get your conclusions from?
It was kind of a conundrum, isn't it? Because how do you find out what's in people's mind and what they value? And I suppose it's very contemporary to say, all right, we value most that which is most expensive. And so we put the largest price on something that we value. Now, we don't have price lists from the early Middle Ages, but the early Germanic law codes listed a price penalty if you violate. If you steal a cow, what's the restitution? So by comparing all of these different values for penalties in the laws, I came up with a hierarchy of value for what people thought of animals.
Okay, so what's number one?
Well, I was sort of surprised because I kind of expected food to be right up there. I mean, frequently is with me, to be honest. But
and so a cow being sort of the biggest source of food?
Although the cow wasn't the biggest source of food, wasn't what people ate.
Well, I mean biggest in a unit sense.
Unit sense. But actually, it's what works for you.
In
other words, what animal does your labor is the largest value versus what animal, what you can eat.
So that tough old ox would be more valuable than the cow.
More valuable than a cow if he can work longer. And so then you can also, I also could calculate how valuable an animal is versus a peasant or versus a nobleman. Mm. So you can see if you kill an animal, how much is that? And it's huge. For example, killing a person between the ages of 50 and 70 years old in the Visigothic laws costs you 200 gold pieces. And where if you were to, in a Visigothic law, overworking an animal or freeing a horse from its hobbles so he could escape would only cost you one gold piece.
Oh.
So in the great hierarchy of being, and all of this is about hierarchy, animals, even the best animals, are way lower.
Yes, yeah, so 1 to 200.
Than a person. And so you have to calculate what people valued, or at least I tried.
So a house cat would be, what, maybe one tin piece.
Okay, cats are a whole different issue because cats really weren't properly domesticated. The biologists can tell us that domesticated animals, you can tell by their bones if they're domesticated. The faces shorten, the bones thin, and that doesn't happen with cats. So on the sort of biological level, cats aren't properly domesticated, so they're semi-domesticated, exactly
really?
In the same way that a mouse is.
Even into the Middle Ages, they're not really domesticated.
We could discuss whether they're domesticated today.
Well, that's true.
I don't think their bones have changed today, that they haven't made that contract with us. Like the mice that all too often share our homes this time of year particularly, The cats share our homes, too. And so they share our homes, and they're originally supposed to eat the mice who shared our homes, but I think they've gotten lazier in their old age.
What kind of attitudes do you see towards some of these animals that are owned as property? If we think of fear or, you know, affection, sympathy, kind of the human emotions shown towards these animals that are laboring for us or kind of sharing our lives. In the Middle Ages, what kind of perceptions do you have?
In the Middle Ages, the animal was valued for what it could do for you. Before about the 12th or 13th century, we don't have evidence for affection. Now, I have to think that somebody cared for the horse or cared for that nice sheepdog that herded your sheep. But in fact, we have no evidence beyond that. The loyalty arrow went one way. The dogs were supposed to be loyal to you. When the dog was no longer helpful, you would kill it.
What sort of animals would people in the Middle Ages eat? Would they eat animals that we wouldn't think of today and vice versa?
I think we are getting more omnivorous, oddly, than they were in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, the Christian Middle Ages we're talking about, you were not supposed to eat a carnivore. So the only exception to that were pigs, who are omnivores. And they let that in under a sort of a loophole in which Christians were defining themselves as not Jews. So if a Jew doesn't eat a pig, then a Christian can eat a pig. So the pigs are the only omnivores that slide in. So they believed that to eat a carnivore is really too much meat. I think we could say they were probably right when we look at mad cow disease, which was passed along by cows eating cows, yeah. Which is wrong.
You've got to wonder, don't you?
Yeah,
there wasn't some retribution involved there. Well, so that's not terribly different from what modern times, I won't say contemporary times.
Although you can go get lion meat now.
Well, now you can,
yes.
Sure. Yeah,
yes.
I mean, there are places where they would eat dogs, but even most of the Native Americans would shunned Lewis and Clark for eating dogs in a pinch.
Although the Native Americans ate puppies happily.
Yeah, some of them did. But
yes.
But that's an interesting distinction between the carnivore and the non-carnivore as
what you're supposed to eat. And the Chinese, you know, happily ate carnivore. The idea of taking carnivores off the table is only possible when you have enough herbivores to eat.
Right.
If you beggars can't be choosers, I'm thinking.
What about the medieval attitude toward appetites in general? I know we'll talk in a little bit about the sexual appetites, but if we look just at the appetite for eating, what kinds of, I don't know, I guess discomfort do you find expressed by medieval writers about the actual process of needing to eat food, needing to eat carnivores and so on?
Well, it is tricky because they have decided that once you go to heaven, you won't need to eat. You know, so that bodies will stay static. And, of course, eating is a function of building your body and replacing those things. So in heaven, you don't need to eat.
My heaven, I get to eat and I don't gain weight.
I get to eat bonbons as well. Leave the meat behind and give me the chocolate. But it raised theologians all sorts of questions. For example, Tertullian struggled with the idea of, if you're not going to eat in heaven, will you have teeth in heaven? Worse yet, will you have bowels in heaven if you're not going to use them?
Right.
And the answer was yes.
Just for display purposes?
Display purposes. Uh-huh. You wouldn't look as good without your teeth. That would, and also as identity. If you carried these body parts with you through this life, you probably are somewhat attached to them, and you'll want them in the next life. So the whole question of food is a little bit problematic. And the problem also comes with what happens after you die, leaving aside heaven. I mean, before we even get there, there is the problem of being eaten by worms, which is always somewhat disagreeable.
Yes.
At least I imagine it is.
Yes.
And so then if you die and if your body then is eaten by a worm, will your body get put together again so you can go to heaven? And the answer was, yes, saved bodies will then be sent up to heaven. But damned bodies will go to hell and continue to be eaten. And hell is seen as a great mouth that chews up people. Let me read you one description of...
This sounds a little like Hieronymus Bosch.
Yes, absolutely it is.
The Garden of Earthly Delights.
But consider consider this, a fearful vision of hell. Fiery dragons were sitting on some of them, them being the damned, and were gnawing them with iron teeth to their inexpressible anguish. Others were victims of fiery serpents, which coiling round their necks, arms, and bodies, fixed iron fangs into their hearts. Toads, immense and terrible, also sat on the breasts of some of them and tried to tear out their hearts with their ugly beaks. So our fear of being eaten raises those same uncomfortable notions every time we eat.
And I suppose it puts us in an odd relationship with animals because we are able to eat animals. We're also able to be eaten by animals, yet we're trying to position ourselves as something other than.
But the animals don't have souls, so it doesn't matter if we eat them.
So it doesn't matter if we eat them because they don't have souls. But there was still some ambiguity that caused some consternation because, for example, if you eat an animal, and they understood that the meat that you ate would turn into your very flesh,
right,
and for men would turn into semen. So then one question might be, why does the child conceived resemble the father and not last night's pork chop?
Well, some of them do resemble last night's pork chop. it does get interestingly complicated, doesn't it, in
yes,
terms of even the significance of eating versus being eaten.
Very complicated. So when they confidently said, oh, humans are different from animals, they are our property, they are our food, as soon as you actually start thinking about it, the lines between humans and animals blur within the human digestion.
Well, right.
Nothing
yeah,
more.
Yeah, once you absorb it, it does become part of you. There's no way around that, is there?
And
vegetarianism, of course.
Right. Well,
then you could
right.
become a potted plant instead of
also soulless, but somewhat more friendly.
Yes.
Blurring the lines even more would be animal sexuality in the relationship between human beings and animals in that way. And we're going to talk about that controversial topic when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Unceasingly, he roams in pursuit of the female and is greatly excited by the frenzy of desire. He drops foam upon the ground and gnashes the white hedge of his teeth, panting hotly, and there is much more rage about his mating than modesty. That is an account by a Roman author of, well, the animalistic approach toward sex. And we are looking at not just sex during this conversation, but also at, in general, medieval attitudes towards animals and the line between humans and animals. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Joyce Salisbury, who has written a book called The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages. It's pretty obvious that at any point in history, people would observe animals not just having sex, but actually wanting them to do so in order to procreate so that we could have, you know, more cattle, more sheep, maybe even more dogs. But inevitably, those attitudes are going to get very colored and colorful, aren't they?
Well, and the problem was, as we've seen, people wanted to separate themselves from animals. And so if that boar, the sexual boar that you read about is the characteristic of animal sexuality, then people began to think, okay, how do people do it? And so then the idea of human sexuality had to be governed as much as possible by reason, not by lust like the boar. But of course, it gets very complicated because as soon as a man hunted a boar and killed him, a very difficult thing, his prize was to eat the testicles so that then he could absorb some of that passion that you read on the attitude of the boar.
Once the indigestion passed. Yeah.
I'm thinking. Fortunately, the women weren't allowed to eat the testicles, so
does that engender, so to speak, a kind of more courtly attitude toward procreation in the Middle Ages? If animals are like this, should we be more circumspect and more formal in our relationships?
Absolutely. And Augustine wrote a great deal on that, the church father. I mean, he said your goal is try to have sex with as little passion as possible, and his recommendations included position only face-to-face. And so other animals, by the way, bears and snakes who copulated face-to-face, then got some credit.
They got elevated somehow in the scheme of things.
Exactly.
Bears and snakes. That would be a tough sell, wouldn't it, given the Garden of Eden?
Do you think that's true that snakes copulate face-to-face? I don't even know. but
they thought so then.
They thought so. So that mattered. Mm-hmm. And so that Augustine said, all right, you have to be careful about your position so that you don't copulate like an animal. Mm-hmm. And he recommended not using birth control so you didn't feel lust because you'd be worried about paying for the fruits of your labors. And and he also recommended thinking about your parents when you were in bed. He thought that would take the edge off.
It certainly would, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Uh-huh.
You also, in the chapter on animal sexuality, quote Albert the Great, who contrasted the fact that animals mated in a loud and noisy fashion, whereas he said humans should be discreet, rational, prudent, and bashful.
Exactly.
And why would Alfred the Great have an opinion to express on this? I mean, why would he feel that
he was writing about animals? So he was distinguishing, once again, between humans and animals. And he said, for example, human beings, semen is the only one that's influenced by astrology.
So that, for example, if your child is born in this sign of the zodiac, he or she will have certain characteristics?
And that's because the father's semen had been influenced, mm-hmm. where he says animal semen is not so influenced by the heavens, only the earth. So he was calculating all of these differences between human sexuality and animal sexuality. And of course, the lines blurred when humans had sex with animals, which was a...
Yeah, well, were there pronouncements against that, I assume?
Well, there were. And actually, one of the things that caused me to begin to write about on this topic was because when I was reading some of the early penitentials banning things like bestiality, in the early centuries, the penalty against bestiality was no more than masturbation. So they didn't think anything of it because the animal was nothing. He was so different from us, it was nothing.
I'm trying to remember my Bible as to...
Leviticus, the endless Leviticus.
Well, isn't there, you shall not lie with any beast?
If a man lies with mm-hmm. a beast, they'll
right.
kill. But
right.
remember, they're eating pork. So they're,
well, they're already a they're, step away from the book.
They're mm-hmm. already playing fast and loose mm-hmm. with sort of the letter of the biblical law. So that in the early Middle Ages, they believed, no, it doesn't matter. But in the late Middle Ages, people were executed for bestiality. So I thought, well, that's pretty
peculiar.
Yeah,
why the twist?
Exactly. And that's what led me to write this book, to see what would cause the change between treating it as nothing to treating it as a capital offense.
And what do you think the reason is?
And I think the reason is in the 12th century, when we began to see ourselves as animals, then the fear came into our mind that we could become animals. We could get lost in an animal. And how can you get lost in an animal most readily?
Yes, by getting romantic with
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Well, then what brought about that change in thinking?
Why we became
more like yes. animals. Why
yes.
we saw ourselves.
How did we become more like animals? And we're talking about what, by the 12th century?
By the 12th century. Well, I argue that it has to do with literature. I know, that seems a little odd to put literature above sex with animals in the great scheme of things of changing people's minds, but I believe it's so. So what happened in the 12th century, the popularity of animal fables, stories in which an animal could be an example to us, right? You're smart as a fox.
So we're talking about anthropomorphism?
Yes, in a sense, mm-hmm. in these fables. And so metaphor, I think, is an arrow that cuts both ways, right? If you say the wolf is like a human, but then the human is like a wolf.
Logically, it's inescapable, right?
Yes. And so then with the popularity and the spread of these stories that offered examples of ways from animals, how we could learn, then people began to see themselves as animals. And then when they turned around to look at the world and the world of animals, perhaps these animals seemed not so much like objects anymore.
But that would raise the question, why was there a new popularity for the fables?
Well, in part, it's like so many things, chance. In part, there was a great deal more literacy. So there were always fables in the ancient Roman world. You know about Aesop's fables.
Sure, yes, go way back.
And Aesop, by the way, resembled an animal in the stories. I mean, so they said, gee, he looks like a goat or a monkey. So here you have an animal-like creature telling tales about animal exemplars. But in the 12th century, these stories, a woman, Marie of France, popularized them for the courts. She changed the morals a bit, but brought the stories back. And then preachers thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. And then preachers took on the stories. And then as they went out in the countryside and preached, then suddenly all of these stories became more popular.
What are some of the examples of animal fables that we might know of from this time?
Oh, I know you know of a lot of them. Let me think.
Would it be things like the tortoise and the hare? Or
sure. Or do you know the country mouse and the city mouse, right? Or or how about the one of the hungry wolf who came up and saw the fat, happy domestic dog? And the dog says, oh, you could have an easy life. I get my food all the time. And then the wolf looks at the dog and says, why is the hair sort of rubbed off your neck? And he says, oh, you just have to wear a collar and then you get snacks. And the wolf thought, okay, never mind. So then issues of freedom or issues of
wildness
too, yeah. All of those become an example of what is it you want to see. And the peculiar things or the fun things, I think, are in some way are the morals of these stories. And one of the things that Marie of France did was that she took the ancient fables that often had a revolutionary moral and then turned them into morals of staying in your place, staying in your hierarchy, and the rich and the obey your king. There's a fable of a hare, you know, the rabbit, and he wanted to wear horns like a deer. Uh-huh. And so the hare wanted to move out of his space. And Marie of France used this fable and said, folks covetous and miserly, they always start such projects as they think will raise their social class. What they attempt through foolishness turns back on them injurious.
Yeah, so but also says, the stuff of great sitcoms. So, you know, yes. Over the centuries, so many of them are founded on that, trying to get out of your class.
Getting out of your class, exactly. And so she wanted to make sure that people didn't and that they stayed put. Well, with that popularity of the message, of such a conservative message, you can see that people were willing to tell these tales everywhere. But, you know, nothing simple. So what people heard was, oh, my God, there must be an animal inside me.
The animal within. Do we have any kind of church leaders speaking out at this point about this topic of human versus animal, or is this all from a sort of a more popular approach?
In very many ways, it was a popular approach. We love those fables, don't we? We love these in the same way we like cartoons and teddy bears, right? We love these animal exemplars. But all the church leaders weren't uniformly agreeable. Bernard of Clairvaux has the most, in the 12th century, warned against this new preoccupation. He said, to what purpose all these unclean apes, those monstrous centaurs, those half-men? Here is a four-footed beast with a serpent's tail. There is a fish with a beast's head. Here again, the forepart of a horse trails half a goat behind it, or a horned beast bears the hindquarters of a horse. For God's sake, if men are not ashamed of these follies, why at least do they not shrink from the expense of painting them?
That's a good punchline there.
Well, and that brings up hybrids in general. And that whole idea of sort of half human, half animal seems to go way back with all these figures that are part horse and part person or a mixture of things. What did you find in sort of in general about hybrids?
Well, and you're right. They go way back to the classical world. The Romans and the Greeks, they had half critters everywhere. And as you can imagine, the Christians, once they were deciding that, no, humans are one thing, animals are another, we're not going to have any of this hybrid business. Augustine, for example, renounced any kind of hybrid or shape-shifting or metamorphosis or anything. He said, and so I should not believe on any consideration that the body, to say nothing of the soul, can be converted into the limbs and features of animals by the craft or powers of demons. He was certain that humans were humans, And he was in the 4th century. Humans were humans, and there will be no carryover.
And no gods turning into animals, because you go back to classical times and you have Zeus taking the shape of animals to rape women.
Exactly. A nice bestiality motif there, isn't it? Yes. Yes. And so if even gods were doing it. And that's why he said, no, you know, no gods do that. I mean, who wants a god that can turn into an ox? A raping ox, you know? That'd be ridiculous.
Definitely a step down.
Yes.
Were there gender distinctions made in the Middle Ages between, you know, women might get blended with this kind of animal? I mean, male obviously would be the boar, but...
Well, once people decided that some, after the 12th century and into the 13th, that some people were more animal-like than others, then, as you can imagine, women more quickly slipped into the animal realm. Let me tell you, a 13th century... tale, Gerald of Wales, he was less certain about the separation of humans and animals. One evening, he happened to meet a girl whom he had loved for a long time. He was enjoying himself in her arms and tasting her delights, when suddenly, instead of the beautiful girl, he found in his embrace a hairy creature, rough and shaggy, and indeed repulsive beyond words. As he stared at the monster, his wits deserted him, and he became quite mad.
This reminds me of a cartoon I saw, The Lockhorns, a few years ago, where they're in bed and he is looking over at her and she's in her curlers and, you know, the mud pack and all that. And he says, "You fiend, what have you done with my wife?"
You hate when that happens.
Yeah, darn.
But so that they began to be concerned that, you know, these lines could blur. And so it was not only women. Women were by definition closer to animal because they were less rational. You'll recall when we began, we said, what are humans? Humans have reason and animals are passionate. And they said, oh, well, women are more passionate. That must mean they're more like animals, right? May I read you just a little list, a little poem, kind of a misogynist poem. A woman is a snake to be venomous. A woman is a lion for imperiousness. A woman is a leopard to devour. A woman is a fox to deceive. A woman is a bear to be combative. A woman is a dog to have sharp senses. A woman is a cat to bite with teeth. A woman is a rat to destroy. A woman is a mouse to be sneaky. So you can see she is like, with this metaphor cutting both ways, she is at heart like an animal.
And you link it in that same chapter, I think, to attitudes toward Jews.
Yes, which is a very horrible and scary thing, because once you've decided that people are the other, you know, that some people are the other, it's bad enough when they're the other, but now, after the 12th, 13th century, the other becomes more animal-like. And so Jews, too, were considered to be more animal-like, and among the animal they were most like was the pig that they refused to eat.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I know. Isn't it wonderful? Yes, human beings, we aren't logical for all our reason. But show you how horrible this gets. If a Jew was to be executed and hung, he would be hung upside down, which was a punishment reserved for pigs that were hung, to die more slowly upside down instead of by the neck. And to give you some further idea, one jurists included intercourse with Turks, Saracens, or Jews as bestiality. And he said, inasmuch as such persons in the eye of the law and our holy faith differ in no wise from beasts. He said, one Parisian man was executed for having relations with his Jewish mistress. And it said, since intercourse with a Jewess is precisely the same as if a man should copulate with a dog.
So this has this would be a little later in the Middle Ages then.
That's certainly
post-12th century.
Post-12th century. And so 13th and 14th, more and more people began to be concerned.
So they're ratcheting up the concern here about the difference between people and animals or the lack thereof.
And ironically, as soon as you see the animal within, it doesn't yield more compassion to who we are. On the contrary, in much of the time, it yields more anger as we try to maintain our humanity by separating ourselves from some beast or another.
As if we're afraid of what we could become, and so we have to find a scapegoat, a name which, you know, suggests the sort of animal-like nature of the whole thing. Can you also talk about attitudes toward homosexuality?
In the same way, it's considered early in the Middle Ages, no more than masturbation. A boy's game, usually boys, they didn't worry about girls. A boy's game that he would grow out of. In the later Middle Ages, it was considered bestiality. to be ranked with, and they use the word sodomy equal to mean bestial intercourse or homosexuality.
There's a biblical base in that at all?
I told you we'd been playing fast and loose with Leviticus the whole time anyway.
Right, yes. I mean, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah and all that notwithstanding. But
it's whether or not you choose to look at that text or not.
Sure. So where did the shift in thinking come in terms of homosexuality then?
12th, 13th century.
And brought about by fables or by what?
That I'm less certain. I think in large part it was brought about by increasing concern with regulating all kinds of activities, right? Whether it's sex with animals or confessing. By the 13th century, everyone was supposed to go to confession at least once a year, which they didn't have to before. And so once you start ratcheting up what you're confessing and then you're controlling, the whole issue becomes more controlling. Privacy becomes not so much.
What about witchcraft?
Witchcraft, too, is obviously, you know, people accuse the medieval people as persecuting more witches.
It's the Renaissance.
It's really the Renaissance. You know, when they get sort of concerned with all these blurring of images, the way it's affected with animals is that they believed that demons would then appear as animals. So apparently almost any animal could be a demon in disguise. And so some people, for example, if they had intercourse with an animal, might say, well, it really was a demon, which still is under the issue of bestiality, a demon being something not human. But at least it perhaps wasn't their fault.
Oh, so they were seduced rather
than... Yeah, exactly.
Well, like the serpent in the garden.
Like the serpent in the garden, exactly.
We'll look further at the fascinating world of the Middle Ages and the shifting attitudes then between what was human and what was animal. Attitudes, some of which are still with us. Back in a moment. This is University of the Air.
In 1386, a pig was found guilty of tearing the face and arms of a child, causing its death. The sow was tried, found guilty, and its head and forelegs were maimed in imitation of the damage done to the child. The sow was then dressed in a man's clothes and, thus attired, executed in the public square. The state paid the usual expenses to the executioner, more than it might have paid a butcher, and even bought the executioner a new pair of gloves so his hands were clean of guilt of shedding blood. This was the standard expense and ritual for an executioner who fulfilled a capital execution on a human. So during the entire proceeding, down to the expenses, the pig was treated as a human. That's an account from the chapter called Animals as Humans in the book The Beast Within, Animals in the Middle Ages by Joyce Salisbury, our guest this hour on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Well, Joyce, this idea of a pig being on trial really blurs the distinction and being dressed in human clothes.
And it was amazing how many of trials there were from the 13th century, really on into the 18th century, of putting animals on trial. And not only putting them on trial, but paying defense attorneys to defend the animals. And some of the more interesting texts come out of the arguments of the defense attorney and the prosecutor as to whether this animal should go on trial or not. For example, it argues that the animal has agency, had made decisions about, had made a choice to commit murder.
It even implies the animal knew that it was doing right and wrong.
Exactly. And some of the defense attorneys said, well, wait a minute. No, animals are irrational. You remember we established that at the beginning of the hour. Animals are irrational. They can't know right from wrong. And the prosecutor argued, well, we put insane people on trial and they have no reason. So therefore, the animal can go on trial as well. And some of the arguments, I mean, suggest to me that surely these people had a sense of humor. For example, there were rats put on trial for eating grain. And the defense attorney argued that you couldn't try the rats properly because they couldn't come to court for fear of the cats who were hanging around. And since the prosecutor couldn't restrict all the cats, the case was thrown out of court. And before we laugh too hard about the rats, in New England in the 17th century, rats also were brought on trial, and the defense attorney argued that they weren't properly served with a summons. And so the prosecutor put the summons on leather, rubbed it with a little grease, tacked it on the outside of the courthouse, and once the rats had chewed on it,
digested
they were served.
It, so to speak.
Yes, they were, exactly. Mm-hmm. They were properly served so they could be put on trial.
And they were only identified because one of their friends ratted on them.
Anyway. But what would be the purpose of putting a rat on trial for eating grain or for doing something else? I mean, it seems so frivolous.
You know, I would love to give you a definitive answer, but I can't. I have no idea. I mean, the only thing that comes to mind is to lots of people have argued, well, maybe it was to give an example for the pig, you know, once you hang the pig. Well, to other pigs. But the other pigs weren't witnesses to this. So it couldn't have been about that, and it couldn't have been about the owner. I think it's one more example of if we have found the beast within us, maybe we have found the human in the animal. The lines have blurred so that maybe we should treat them as we might a human being.
Might, I suppose, have an element of purgation to it. We were kind of projecting our faults onto this pig, this rat, whatever it is, and then getting rid of it.
The old scapegoat notion.
Roughly the same as a scapegoat, yeah.
And yet, obviously, even if you found all the rats guilty, what have you accomplished? You haven't really accomplished anything. But I think it's just the love of the law in the sense that we are in charge with this legal mechanism.
And that the law covers every aspect of our existence.
Exactly.
There is an answer to every question.
There's an answer to every question, that we are in charge. And this is extremely controversial today, even, this question of whether animals should be tried before the law. There are a number of jurists who argue that, for example, when the Humane Society kills animals for homelessness, that perhaps they should have a defense attorney regarding that. Or when someone's pit bull kills someone, who is found guilty?
The owner of the pit bull.
In a case in Baltimore, the owner of the pit bull was found guilty. And so when the judge tried to write an order to kill the pit bull, the defense attorney said, wait a minute, that's double jeopardy. You've found the owner guilty. The pit bull walks.
So that gets really tricky.
It really does get tricky.
But animals are put on trial.
They are.
In this country, fairly often, as it turns out.
And whether they have a defense attorney or not. Remember in Yellowstone, didn't a mother bear and two cubs kill some campers?
Yes.
The mother bear was killed, but the two cubs were freed. And it's very much a medieval parallel, a sow and her piglets caught with blood on their mouths from killing someone. And the sow was killed, and the piglets were released under the notion that their mother was a bad example. And I think the bears got off. The bear cubs got off under the same loophole, didn't they?
Well, I would think the concept of what is natural would come into play. I mean, what do we accept as just being natural behavior, part of nature? As you see the medieval thinkers on this progressing, how did they view natural?
And it was a problem, particularly not so much when they were trying domesticated animals, pigs, they're easy. But when you're going for something like a locust, you know, well, maybe God gave the locust the right to eat this grain. That's the natural idea. And they had to wrestle with that because, after all, who knows exactly what God's plan was for any particular locust versus any particular patch of grain? So it's not an easy answer, well, then, as it is now. I think once you start putting the lawyers involved here, it got very complicated, didn't it?
Well, certain animal attributes, of course, are considered desirable. And perfect late 12th century example, Richard the Lionhearted.
Ah, yes. But you know, you never say Richard the Dog.
And well,
not in a good way, not to his face. Exactly.
Right.
And which is another way of separating us from animals. We use as a compliment the animals that are the furthest from us, a lion, the most different. We can take on their attributes. But the animals that are closest to us, a dog, a pig, a monkey, those are insults. as a way of separating ourselves from an animal that might really be threatening to our identity.
What about instances where, well, let's say werewolves, or times where you have people sort of turning into something monstrous or animal-like?
Yes. Well, at the late Middle Ages, it seemed that the world was inhabited by shape-shifting creatures like werewolves. And in fact, there's a whole genre of sympathetic werewolves. Now, you wouldn't think that a werewolf would be something that, well, one of the earlier medieval thinkers said, well, a werewolf, that's just such a mean wolf that it's someone you should beware of. So we call it a werewolf. But let me tell you Maria France. Let me tell you a short story of Maria France's werewolf, one of the first sympathetics, werewolves. So there was a king, and he was a wonderful king, kind to all his subjects, except he just had this one little thing. 3 days a week, he went in the woods, took off his clothes and put them under a big flat rock, and was a werewolf for 3 days a week. Then he put his clothes back on, and he was a wonderful king. Perfect. The beast within was accommodated. It was all just fine. Ah, but then he got married, and his wife kept saying, so where do you go 3 days a week? and he didn't want to explain, and then he finally did. And then from that moment on, she couldn't see the man. She could only see the beast. So she got a knight, and she had him steal his clothes. So he was stuck in the werewolf. And the townspeople heard this loud lamenting in the woods of the howling werewolf in anger and rage. And one day, a neighboring king rode through the woods, and this wolf came up and touched his foot. And the king saw the man inside the wolf. And so they became hunting partners, and one day they went to visit his original castle. And the wolf, as soon as the door was opened, he killed the knight who had taken his place and bit the nose off his ex-wife. And the king said, this is not like my wolf. What's going on here? So he looked into the situation, restored the werewolf's clothing. He exiled his wife, who bore three noseless daughters in the future. And then the king lived happily ever after. So what do we make of this story? I mean, here you have a perfect acceptance of a human who's a beast, a sympathetic werewolf who can be the best of the king. And what else do we make of this misogynist tale? Don't tell your wife a secret or...
Well,
allow your husband to have his animal.
His 3 days out.
People need their space, you know, whether it's turning into a werewolf or just playing cards with the guys, you know. Or,
allow
or
your husband
hunting.
To howl.
Yeah.
I'm sure Freud would have fun with
it's
all of this.
Necessary to accommodate those marginal aspects of the human
of
existence.
Our human, you see?
Yes.
And all
Not
of the ways
them.
We've said that means we've kind of accepted this beast that kind of prowls within our human beings. We don't draw the line so vividly, and maybe all the Twilight movies mean the same thing, don't they?
Well, that really raises the big question, is the difference between acknowledging or recognizing and accepting that beast within. And in the Middle Ages, accepted?
Well, Marie's werewolf story, it was fine, so long as, you know, everybody accepted, there wasn't a problem, right?
You'd have to wonder a little bit how that squares with theology, though. I mean, is there a theological in the Middle Ages accommodation for people getting a little weird every now and then?
Not so much. So the theologians, well, even with Darwin, you know, the theologians weren't wildly happy with that. So, yeah, I mean.
Well, I was thinking, I mean, this is a lot later than the time of your book, but if you think of the Puritans or the Victorians and the strenuous efforts to clothe the body, to hide anything that would suggest animal-like behavior, you know, just much more repression, I guess, than.
And why would you repress it so? It's because it's really ready to prowl. And we haven't talked much about pets, speaking of repression, because the earliest pets really begin in the 12th and 13th century, at least in the West, after the classic. The Romans had pets. But in this Christian period, and it was women, and the descriptions of them, the pets sitting in their laps, little lap dogs licking their lips and giving them kisses as the little dogs would sit there and do nothing except provide affection, you know. So here you can see animals starting to be the outlet for affection.
And what do you suppose brought that about?
Once you allow that we're like
animals. Then
animals can be like humans. And then you can start having pets and affection for them.
But unlike humans, you are much more likely to have control over your pet. So, again,
that's a good thing, right? Still,
yeah, well, yeah, we hope so.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's, again, it's back to the – a pet is back to the concept of animal as property.
Except that raises the question, and it's a question that we're talking about the law. As late as the 17th century, the English law codes said if someone steals a pet, it's not theft because that animal is useless. It's only if someone steals your working animal that it's theft of property. So then the question is, and today, if someone kills your pet, you can't sue them for loss of affection.
You can't.
No, you can only sue them for depreciation of a property.
So depreciation.
So if it's an old dog, you get nothing. Uh-huh. It's like your car.
You write in your book, humans are uncomfortable with ambiguity. Yet we seem so fascinated by going right to this edge, you know, the edge between animals and humans. And if you think of werewolves and all the fantastic creatures that are part animal and part human. If you think about Halloween and how you like to put on kind of monstrous looking costumes.
Don't forget those vampires.
Or black cats or whatever, that we sort of the spooky aspect of things, the grotesque, the delight in having something that scares us a little bit. Why do you think that is?
Well, don't you think it's because we are uncomfortable with that, that we always try to tantalize ourselves with that with which we are uncomfortable? And Halloween, I mean, early in many of the early portions of it, you dress up as an animal to use up your animal nature that day so you'll be more human afterwards. So you use up the chaos on Halloween so that then the chaos is held at bay. It's a way of demarking it and setting it aside. So perhaps the ambiguity will be receded for another year.
Just in time for All Saints Day.
Yes, exactly.
What about saints in this topic?
Well, I close my book with a consideration of saints and the chapter of what is a human. And so I consider saints in the Middle Ages were quintessentially human, the superhumans. And so in the early Middle Ages, their miracles were to make animals not act like animals. So to make lions not eat you and make birds not eat your grain. But by the late Middle Ages, with St. Francis, the one we all remember, he takes care of animals for their own sake. So he'll save a lamb from being eaten for no reason other than that it's a lamb. Or I also like St. Bartholomew's duck. St. Bartholomew sitting there praying, and then this duck comes and pulling on his coat. And he's like, okay, what? And the ducklings had fallen down a crevice, and Bartholomew went and restored the ducks, and they all went off and did their duck thing, and he went off and did his praying thing. So there was no use to him for that duck. So the animals, the saints in the late Middle Ages, started seeing a use of animals, a value of animals for themselves. So the saints make my case for me as well.
Well, you're in good company then. Joyce Salisbury has been our guest for this hour, taking us into the Middle Ages to look at the beast within. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me here. I enjoyed it.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. His most famous painting is one of the most famous in the world, American Gothic. Next Sunday afternoon at 4, join us with biographer Tripp Evans for a look at the curious life and the art of Grant Wood. That's next Sunday afternoon at 4, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.